And welcome to another edition of Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries all across the globe, as well as various metaphysical topics. And today, it's all about changing your beliefs and limiting your beliefs and how to break through that. So I've invited Deborah Hill on the show. She has a new book out. It's called Unlimited Life, Limiting Beliefs and Belief-Busting Power Truths. So, Deborah, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, thank you for joining us from Atlanta, correct?
Thank you for having me. A nice toasty 90, high 90s here.
Right, it's hot summer. So why don't you tell me about your background a little bit? I know you call yourself an intuitive coach?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been intuitive all my life. I really started developing those skills throughout my life through writing, but really discovered the extent of them in the last 15 years and started studying with several teachers throughout the country on how to use that ability to help other people. And in the meantime, throughout my life, I've had 4 degrees. I studied pre-med and then went into nursing and nurse midwifery. I studied all forms of natural healing. And through my nurse's training, learned a lot about counseling, all my degrees at psychology. So intuitive coaching is a combination of all that, where I coach people and help people to take their next step or work through barriers. And at the same time, I'm able to see what's going on and to help them to see that.
I see. So you do a lot of one-on-one work with people?
One-on-one and speaking, yes.
Okay. So let's talk about the economy. We keep hearing in the news and the media how it's crashing and tanking and how can we, when we see these reports or hear them on the news, how can we change that and make it more positive?
Well, first of all, realize that while there are certain things going on, it doesn't mean that everything's going to be that way forever. You see, our beliefs define us. If we truly believe that our world is crashing around us, we're going to create that for ourselves. We don't have to believe that. We can ride this wave. And we can believe that everything is going to be fine and that we can make the most out of this. So I know I'd stop watching the news at 10 o'clock because then I'd have it sitting in my head all night and
right.
I'd wake up real scared with this Chicken Little voice going, the sky is falling, the sky is falling.
Yeah, it's been relentless for the past year.
It has. And it's interesting if you remember back before the stock market crashed, like, you know, or recessed back in 2001, all you heard on the news was how great the economy was. So that's what the news does. It tells you what's going on, but that doesn't mean that that's doom of forever. It means that's what's going to happen for a little bit, but it's always going to correct, and that's one of the beliefs that you can have. One of the beliefs I like to take advantage of is whatever goes down must come up.
Right, and people have to understand that in television you get higher ratings when you scare people and talk about negative things and scary things.
Exactly.
And
there are a lot of
headlines
people
as well.
Yes, and it's good to look around at people who are doing really well in these times.
And people are thriving. I mean, I know people in my life that are doing extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be you cannot just make a blanket statement about the United States. That, you know, there's millions of people here and we're all doing different things and some of us are thriving.
Exactly. Everybody's having different points in your own life and your life doesn't necessarily have to reflect what's going on in the general economy. And what's going on in the general economy is going to change. It has, you know, it's through the Depression, through the 60s, the end of the 60s, there is a change. There, we had 2001, and there are several other recessions throughout this whole time. I remember when real estate in Miami crashed, and people had a really hard time. But look at it now, you know, it went up, and then now it's going to go down a little bit, and then it will come up again.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just not identify with the whole pattern of the economy and realize you have your own life. Believe it.
Right.
You can create that happening in your own life.
Let me ask you, what if someone has a goal for something they really want to do, But it's hard. Maybe they want, let's say, their own television show.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this voice in their head that says, well, that's one in a million, and it's going to be really hard. How can they overcome that and make a difficult goal seem easier?
That's a good question. And what they've obviously done is they've already created a strong desire, because the law of attraction, which is something that I've used for years, really states that you have to create a strong desire. And then it's real important to define exactly what that goal is. Where on TV are they going to be? What's their career going to do? And then notice the anxiety and the thoughts that are happening in your head. What are you feeling? If you're feeling anxious or you're feeling emotional, depressed, frustrated, or if you have thoughts going on, just notice the thoughts that are going down, and you might even write them down. And then talk to yourself. Tell yourself, you know, I understand how you feel, self. That makes a lot of sense based on what you've seen in the past or your history. But why don't we try turning things around? Because if we keep projecting these negative thoughts, that's not going to happen in our life. Let's just experiment. Have empathy and compassion, but try to talk yourself into thinking something better. Point out to yourself that if you project negativity, you're going to get it back, and you only have so much energy. So wouldn't it be better to just try and think positive? And once you've kind of gotten yourself to listen to it, you can actually do what I do, is a little meditation in my head, is I actually identify what the belief is that's limiting me. And I look in my head and I see that there's an actual sign that has that belief on it. And what I do is I throw that sign away, bring up another sign, all my markers, and I write on this new sign in my head a new positive affirmation. Like, I can be a real tremendous TV star on national or international broadcast.
Could you phrase it in the present or the future?
Well, I can be. I would state it as
I am becoming
present time, but not necessarily I will be.
Like, I am
just
becoming.
I have the ability to do this.
Okay.
This can happen to me.
Right. That's a really good idea, actually. What are some of the I'm assuming that most of us do our own little work, maybe 20 minutes a day on our own personal time.
Mm-hmm.
What are some ideas that people can take into their personal time to manifest what they want or change their beliefs?
Well, for some of the beliefs that first of all, you have to identify what your belief is that's limiting you, and then define for yourself some positive affirmations and create those for yourself and keep changing the sign in your head. Now, if you want some beliefs for the recession right now, or it's not really technically a recession, but working through the economy, this is some of the beliefs that I use. Is that something of interest to you? Some of the beliefs that I use for what's happening with the economy right now?
Yeah, you can go ahead and touch on a couple of those.
For one thing, times like this, where we do have challenges, are really great times. There are times where we can really grow. We can really move ourselves to the next level. It's fun when things are happy, but we're not really necessarily moving. But these times you can grab the bull by the horn and really ride it. So, for instance, a friend of mine last spring, she was having a hard time because she's an engineer and she has other engineers that she's hired, and she lost a couple contracts and she lost one of her engineers and things weren't working very well. And I said to her, this is temporary. You need to really specify what exactly you want to do and broaden yourself. Look at what you really love, expand it, and clean up your desk. Start identifying who you want to hire. Start getting ready, because it's going to get better. And I met with her for dinner last night, and this is one of these people that's doing tremendously well in this economy. She has not only hired a couple more engineers, she has hired architects and a whole lot of other people, and she has two national and one international contract that's come in. that's going to take her business, double it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Yeah, it's happening.
So know that these are challenges and opportunities for growth is one of the things that I use right now.
Right. One of the concepts I became aware of recently, I was listening to a speaker, and she said, don't be afraid to ask others for help. You know?
Yes.
Like, ask around. You let go of your ego, and people, it's human nature to actually want to help people. So go ahead and tap into it.
Exactly. And that's a lot of what the law of attraction does. Not only can you ask other people, but you can put it out to whether you want to call it God or the universal force. Ask for what it is you want.
Right.
I remember I was having a really difficult time as I was leaving town, and I had some real estate closings that were going to happen, and I had some other events that needed to happen, and I needed all these people to call me, and they weren't calling me back, and I had to go, and it was really stressful. And I meditated, and I got this voice from one of my guides saying, you know, tell us what you want. And I said, well, you don't need to do that. You've got to create peace in the world, right? And he said, no, we're here for you.
Be specific, huh?
Just let us help you. That's what we do. And I just made a list, and within the next morning, within 2 hours, the lawyer had called me. Everything, the closing had happened, everything got cleared up within 2 hours.
Right.
You have this whole team out there, teams here on Earth and teams in other realms that can really help
you. Well, you're saying exactly what Doreen Virtue is saying, that the angels are all around and they're just waiting for an invitation.
Exactly.
Come in and help. So you're kind of confirming her information.
And they won't. They do help in some respect to give you notification and tune you into things, or sometimes save your life if you're, you know, in a car accident. They'll get involved. But the really good angels and guides and masters that I've talked to do not interfere. They're like people here. They're not going to start helping you unless you ask them to. If you ask them to, they're there for you. But they give you enough space to do your own thing and have enough respect for you that they're not going to take over. So ask them. Be specific, make the list, and you'd be amazed how quickly it happens.
That's a really powerful concept. Now, here's another example for you. Let's talk about money.
Okay.
Let's say someone has a lot of bills and debts, and they add it all up, and let's say it comes to $100,000, okay?
Mm-hmm.
To just get them feeling good again, they would need $100,000. Should they figure out a way to actually get it, or just leave it up to the universe? What's the best way to manifest that?
It's a combination of things. First of all, define exactly what it is you owe and what you need and when you need it by. Make it very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Then put it out there. You have to make sure you believe that it's going to come to you. So work on the limiting beliefs, like I mentioned, and then put it out there, and then know that it's going to happen. At the same time, get busy. Start watching yourself get into gear. Don't just sit back and wait. It's like that joke. Did you hear the joke about there was a flood and the guy believed in God and God was going to save him? And so the flood came and he got up on his roof and someone came by with a boat and he says, no, God's going to save me. And then he was swimming and then a helicopter sent down a rope and God says, don't worry, God's going to save me. And then he died. And
right.
He went to heaven, and God said, well, I sent you a boat. I sent you a helicopter.
Hello.
Well, you know, you're going to get opportunities to create money. And you got to work. You got to work on those and act on those, and those will help you to really grow in spirit and in your whole person.
Just
at the same time,
yeah.
Don't assume that money has to come from work.
That's really important. I mean, people find money all the time.
Exactly.
Or they win a lotto or something. That is so true. Money's not tied to work.
Money can come from places that you would never expect. Like, for instance, I had a cash flow in situation a few years ago, and I needed, I think it was $729, and I had money coming in, but I didn't have it coming in by the time I needed. And I said, I need $729 to come in within 3 weeks.
Right.
And I just let it go. And I actually forgot that I had asked. And 3 weeks later, I got this check in the mail for a class action suit on a stock that I had bought in 2001 and didn't even know it was happening.
Oh, man.
And
don't
it was for something like $730.
Oh, did they give you a dollar extra?
Yeah, it was exactly what I asked for, you know. With another dollar to spare.
You're telling me you only asked once in your manifestation?
Yeah, you don't want to nag. Because if you're nagging, well, you're being in bad energy. For one thing, if you have to keep asking, you don't believe it's going to come.
Well, what the Abraham tapes say is that you're undermining it if you go back mm-hmm. and kind of harp on it and keep asking.
Yes, you're obviously saying, I don't have it, I don't have it, I don't have it. Because you're asking, please give it, I don't have it. And then the universe hears, I don't have it, I don't have it, I don't have it. And then you don't have it. That's what they give you.
Wow. Yeah, that's really
your faith is so important.
Now,
I know this works for me. And if you keep trying it, and you'll see it really works. And you just have to know you're taken care of.
What do you think of keeping the money or energy flowing? Like, let's say $100 come in, then, you know, go ahead and keep it going. You know, spend it. And keep the energy moving.
I'm fully in belief of that. Money is energy, and you have to keep money moving. Now, that doesn't mean you have to spend it on things that you don't need. You can put it into a mutual fund that's going to move. You're supporting companies that way, or you can put it into stocks. I think it's good to invest in yourself in the future, and what you're doing when you're investing. When you're investing, you're actually creating another business for yourself.
Right.
So you're creating a cash flow.
What do you mean by tithing?
I have mixed feelings. I feel I give a lot to charity.
Mm-hmm.
I love to give. It feels really good to give. And I do know that the most generous people I know are the most wealthy people I know.
Yes.
I know it comes back.
Uh-huh.
I feel like sometimes, and this is for myself, I know they say give 10% for some churches or charities, and I know the books are written that that's the right amount. For me, I give more sometimes, and I give less sometimes.
I see. And
sometimes I don't necessarily pay attention, I'll like to exactly the percentage. Like one example is I like to tip people well.
Okay.
That's giving, I feel.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's an abundance. And it's almost like when you look at a menu, some of us go right to the cheapest thing automatically, you know. It's like we got to let that go.
Right.
And just order whatever you want, regardless of the price.
And know you'll have enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like dieting, you know. If you say you can't have ice cream, boy, you want ice cream.
I know. Exactly. Tell me in your book, which is Unlimited Life, Limiting Beliefs, and Belief-Busting Power Truths. And
right.
Once again, my guest is Deborah Hill, about power truths and how you can use them to recession-proof your life.
Well, what I do is, in my book, as I talk about how beliefs limit you, a little bit more elaborate than what I've done today, and talk about how to change those beliefs, I give a meditation to use. And then I mention 16 limiting beliefs that a lot of us have. For example, I don't have enough time. And I talk about why that's not true, and then I give you power truths to use to replace those limiting beliefs to help you be more successful. And in terms of the recession, some beliefs that I'm using right now are everything that goes down must come back up. Worrying about things I can't control is a waste of my energy. Challenges are opportunity for growth and renewal. Another one that I actually talk about in my book that is so true is I can handle all obstacles put in my path. Something can't be in your path if you can't deal with it. It's just not possible physically, chemically, for an opportunity or a challenge to happen that you cannot work through. I mean, you could choose not to. You can say, forget it, I'm not going to do this, and cop out on it. But you have all the tools you need to deal with that. I mean, think about it. Here you are now. You've had a lot of challenges. You made it. There are times when maybe you thought, I can't deal with this. But you did. And you will.
Right. So, our life kind of unfolds at the rate that we can handle. And the universe has a divine path for us.
Yes.
We just have to trust it.
Right. And we create challenges for ourselves as well, in spirit. Things that we want to learn, things that we want to understand, and we create opportunities for us so that we can get the next lesson. Because we all have an agenda for why we came here and what we want to know and learn and do.
Right. Why don't you, of course, without naming names, talk maybe about a specific client who came to you with a problem and how you helped them overcome it.
Wow.
Pick one.
Okay, I talked about this one person who had her business. I'm sticking with, I'll move on to relationships since we've done a lot with business.
Okay.
But what I do when I look at someone is I look at where they are on their path, what they are in spirit, and how they are adjusting to life, what their issues are, what their strengths are, and how it relates to their path. So, for instance, I had one person who was having difficulty with her son. And I looked at her and I saw there were certain issues with her that she really wanted to fix her son. And that wasn't her job. We're not here to fix other people. That's in my book, too. That's a whole limiting belief that a lot of us have.
Sure.
And we get off on that. But our job is to support others, to be there if they need us, but let them make their mistakes. And it's so hard with someone you love. So first I got her to get her hands off of her son and let him be. And then I was able to see some of the things that were going on with her son to give her a different perspective on her son so she could understand her son better to allow her to let him go more.
Okay.
And also to create strong boundaries for how she wanted to be treated and what she wanted in her own life. And once she did that, she was able to let her son go. He's doing great. She's doing great. They're really happy together. He's very successful, and they have a great relationship. She moved on.
That's really important. So it's just trying, getting out of managing other people's lives, basically.
Right. Other people's problems are not your problem.
Well, what's interesting, I've been noticing lately, when I talk to people, how quickly people jump in and give you advice when you haven't even asked for it, or you might not even know the person that well, and yet 1 minute into the conversation, you're getting advice.
Right.
And there are people like that.
And how does that feel when that happens?
Not too great.
That's,
I mean, once you're an adult, I mean, you really, if you solicit advice, that's one thing.
Right.
But sometimes you're just trying to have a talk with someone. You're just trying to socialize. And yet, the flood of advice comes in.
And you feel disrespected.
Pretty much, yeah.
And plus, you don't know what's right for them.
My daughter,
she went through lots of different careers before she found the one that she wanted. And I kept suggesting, what about this career, what about that career? She chose a career that's totally different than anything I would have ever thought of, and she is so good at it. She found her own way. You know, I talk to the masters, extended masters, and the archangels all the time, and I'll tell you something, they never give me advice.
Interesting.
They will give me information. Have you looked at what's going on over here? Have you noticed this? But they do not tell me what to do. They look at me eye to eye, and they know that I'll figure it out, and they give me that opportunity to do it. It's hard not to give advice, because you want to help somebody. It's so hard to see somebody struggling. You want to fix them. But,
well, I think you know, when you get into metaphysics, this doesn't happen to me in metaphysics circles. People are more zen-like, and they understand we're all on a different path. It happens more to me when I'm out in the general community.
Right.
I recently had someone give me a lot of specific real estate advice about where I should move and what I could afford, and I'm thinking, well, gee, they don't really even know my net worth, or, you know, maybe I have $5 million in the bank. They don't know, or
right.
$5. And, you know, people will make assumptions. And I think the book that's really helped me is The Four Agreements. I don't know if you've read that. But
that's a wonderful book.
Yeah, about one of the agreements is just not to assume things and ask a lot of probing questions before you make your determinations.
And one of the things that I'm also trying to work with people like that, is to let them be who they are when they're giving advice, to not be offended by it, to know they're trying to help, to not tag on to it, but to realize that they're doing the best they can. And that's tough. You know, it's a tough situation to deal with that. And sometimes I try to listen to, maybe there's something in what they're saying that is good that I can use. You know, not maybe in the whole scenario, but maybe sometimes God puts somebody on your path and tells you something, and you don't necessarily want the whole picture, but there's something in there for you. It can show up from a person's mouth or a license plate or a billboard or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you have to keep your antenna up all throughout the day.
Right.
And receive information.
Good analogy. I like that.
Yeah, and the way I've been doing it is a lot of times I'll turn off the radio and music and TV, and so I don't have that interference. And you can go throughout your day without media. It's okay to not get the latest from Hollywood about what actress is, you know, divorcing whoever. And that, then you have time and energy to kind of devote to the world around you.
Exactly. And you create your own reality around you. Sometimes I have to go on the internet or listen to NPR to hear what's going on so I don't sound totally out of touch when someone talks to me about
I go online and I choose the stories I want to read.
Read the headlines and see if it is relevant or I need to know more about that.
Well, there's a balance for sure. Let me get into some specific issues. I have a friend who has a New Age store,
uh-huh.
At a physical store, very few customers coming in, and how can she turn that around and bring in a flow? And then sometimes when the people walk in the store, they kind of pick things up and look at the prices, and you know, they just won't buy it, you know what I mean? There's that scarcity thought.
Mm-hmm.
So how can she turn it around and make her store abundant?
Well, what I'm seeing and also what I've seen in general is New Age is old now.
Mm-hmm.
New Age is becoming a part of everything. So you can go in, I walked into Barnes & Noble, and behind the counter, the whole display was divination decks, tarot, angel cards, and who would believe that that would be there?
Not 5 years ago. You wouldn't believe that. No.
Absolutely. So what would be great is to start attracting other clients as well.
Uh-huh.
Expand from New Age to present age.
Okay.
To bringing in, now there are a lot of people out there who aren't, quote, New Age, who are into reading a lot of these things and buying these things and open to essences and all the things that are sold in New Age stores. So it would be really great to attract those people. And a lot of those people are sort of turned off by the New Agey feel. It's good to keep up the feng shui and the atmosphere and start offering other things as well that will bring them in and change the moniker, so to speak, not just in the whole look and feel of the store, but in how you perceive the store, and also to start visualizing attracting people from corporate and other environments
okay.
who have money.
Right, and we're just working on visualizing just people coming in, you know, and the store being full,
mm-hmm.
and people buying, just basic visualizations.
People who have money coming
okay.
in.
Actually, we haven't done that.
So that's really important.
Maybe that's what we're missing. No, it's true. You have to be specific.
And a lot of us people who've been in the New Age environment have dealt with a lot of poverty consciousness for a long time, and there's a lot of belief that wealthy is not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I just made that up. That's and that if you're wealthy, you're not evolved. And that's not true. It's
yeah.
something we have to let go of.
Right. And now what about, I know a lot of practitioners and out in the audience, there are a lot of like massage therapists and yoga teachers and people that have clientele
mm-hmm.
and their clientele is way down. And they let's say they want 20 a week and they only have like 5. What can they do to like generate action and business again?
Well, there's a couple things to do. First, look at what you're offering, and maybe you want to expand. Maybe this is the time to start studying new techniques and new things that you can also offer. Grow. It's a time to grow. And again, start looking at where is your audience. My daughter is a massage therapist. She works in a resort area, and she's doing very well.
Okay.
Because she's working with people who have money and appreciate it. So start visualizing people coming to your life who have money. I remember this story that one of my teachers told me about this woman who had a jewelry store, and she wasn't doing well at all. So she marked the jewelry down, and still nothing happened. Marked the jewelry down. She was really desperate, but she had to go out of town for a week, and she had a friend watch the store for her, and she said, I need you to cut the prices. Well, she came back, and the friend had sold all the jewelry.
The friend wasn't and desperate, right?
The friend said, oh, you wanted me to cut the prices? I doubled the prices. If you make yourself look like you're not valuable, you're not going to attract people to you. Sometimes the key to getting more business is raising your rates.
Interesting.
If you keep trying to attract people who don't have enough money and you keep lowering your standards to help them come to you, then you're doing both of you a disservice because they don't have the opportunity either to raise more money to be able to afford your services. You're making your services less valuable.
Right. And when stores put up that sign that says 40% off, there's just this whole air of desperation
mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you walk in. And you can just feel, you know, how hard, you know, it is for them. And so that may be attracting desperate people.
Right. They're attracting the poverty consciousness. There was this store around the corner that had an out-of-business sale on it, going out of business. And so, you know, I like to shop. I went in, and I bought a few things. And then the sign stayed up the next week and the next week. They had that sign up for over a year. And people got it, you know. They said, well, for one thing, they were offended. For another thing, they realized there must be nothing left in there, and it didn't look of value. The store really went under.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good technique.
They really did go out of business.
Anyway, tell us one more time as we're winding down here how the name of your book and how to get it.
The name of my book is Unlimited Life, Limiting Beliefs, and Belief-Busting Power Truths. You can get it on my website at yourintuitivelife.com, or you can get it in your bookstore or at Amazon.
Okay, excellent. Lots of ways to get it. And Deborah Hill, once again. So thanks a lot for being on the show, and I wish you well.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Deborah's off the line. So thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you were all inspired by that. And check out her book. So now we're going to a new segment of Odyssey. As most of you know, after the interview, we get into my area of expertise, which is ancient mysteries across the globe and mystical sites and mystical places. And a lot of my research recently has been about cryptozoology, and my source has been the London Society of Cryptozoology, which are, you know, quite a group of serious researchers. And what we find when we look in the past is most ancient cultures believed in animal-human hybrids, that they were not really just mythical characters to these ancient societies. For instance, in Egypt, they believed in a sphinx that was a very real creature to them. It was half lion and half human. And when I looked into this research, I found that in ancient Rome and Greece, they would have sightings of the sphinx, or they would use a sphinx to guard a temple, and that's what they wrote about. And it doesn't appear to be fictional in their writings. And that's just one example. And there's many, many types of these creatures. So the first one we're going to talk about today is the satyr, or also known as a faun. So I'll read you a bit of my new research. The ancient pagan god Pan is often depicted as a satyr, or a faun. His legs are like a calf, but his upper body is human, except for the face, which appears like a goat, with two curly horns on his crown. The satyrs are known for their wild parties and sexual nature, dancing around a glowing fire to the magical sounds of the panpipes. These legendary beasts of the forest had a craving for wine, and often their drunken parties turned violent and angry. This is a far cry from the gentle faun portrayed in the Narnia books as the character of Mr. Tumnus. But even he was supposed to be kidnapping humans, if you remember the tale of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He was there to kidnap the children. In Greek mythology, the satyrs were the constant companions of Dionysus, the god of wine and revelry. And he's also known as Bacchus in Roman mythology. A lot of these Greek and Roman gods overlap, and they're the same characters, and I believe they're all based on the Anunnaki. And different cultures, different names, but same basic personalities. So, by the way, Pan is what I believe the prototype for the character of Satan, with the cloven hooves, and this character that is feared so much in the Christian church, I believe the roots come from this character of the god Pan, the satyr. So a similar type of fearsome beast is known as the centaur. He is human from the waist up and runs on four legs with the body of a horse. He is depicted in astrology as the Sagittarius symbol. The Greek god Chiron was an immortal with the power of prophecy and healing. He was educated by Apollo, but he left Earth after being wounded by one of Hercules' poison arrows. Zeus took pity upon him and turned him into the star constellation of Sagittarius the Archer. The centaur is a powerful athlete, but also shared with the satyr a tendency to become drunk, which often led to fighting and violence. They live in tribes and share a communal wine jar. According to legend, bands of centaurs were known to terrorize local villages from Greece to southern Russia. They have a reputation for being strong, but not particularly intelligent. They also joined the satyrs as followers of Dionysus, also known to Romans as Bacchus. Pliny the Elder reports that he saw one once embalmed in honey, brought over from Rome to Egypt. Pliny the Elder is a Roman historian. He wrote a book about these animal-human hybrids, and it was known as a bestiary. It was an encyclopedia of all of these ancient beasts. And once again, he claimed to have seen a centaur embalmed in honey brought over from Rome to Egypt, and he wrote about it in his book. They are featured in Roman artwork and murals of 2,000 years ago. They were said to retreat to the remote mountains of Asia after the fall of the Roman Empire to practice their skills of hunting and winemaking. So we'll get into dwarves, gnomes, and goblins a little bit. There's a rich tradition in Northern Europe of a belief in the little people, or more specifically, dwarves, gnomes, and goblins. Certainly this all falls into the category of folklore, but this is a good time to remind my listeners of the Flores Island Hobbit I discussed in one of my DVDs, and Ancient Gold Mines. Scientists have discovered a separate species of dwarf about 3 feet high from skeletal evidence on South Pacific Islands, and that is known as the Flores Island Hobbit. And you can look into that, you can look at those pictures online and see that there was a different group or species of little people in the South Pacific. So dwarves and gnomes are closely associated with mining, metalwork, and hoarding of treasure. The men often sport long beards, while the females are rarely seen. They have stocky bodies, while gnomes are thinner and more proportioned to human beings. In Scandinavia, they believe in three types of dwarves. The black dwarf is often sad and solitary, while the brown dwarf is friendly and outgoing. He is more likely to interact with humans, but he can be a trickster. The brown dwarves have been accused of kidnapping children to work in their mines. And so there is that theme again of kidnapping that we talked about with the fawn and the satyr. And if you remember the tale of Rumpelstiltskin, that was also about a dwarf kidnapping a child. So this is very, very common from many, many areas all around the world. The white dwarves of Northern Europe are said to be more friendly to humans, but are guarded and jealous of their privacy. They remain underground during the day, but will feast and carouse at night above ground in the forests during the spring. They are all fine craftsmen in the field of metalsmithing and smelting. In Viking mythology, they created Thor's hammer, Odin's ring, and Freya's necklace. Usually gnomes and dwarves greedily hoard their treasure, but occasionally a human is invited to their underground halls to feast and revel with them. They are gifted with treasure and wealth before they return to the surface. This goes on and on. So let me finish up my cryptozoology section today talking about the Yeti, which is also known as the Abominable Snowman. So this is a very elusive creature often found in the areas around Tibet. The 13th century philosopher Roger Bacon reported that a race of hairy wild men lived in the high mountains of Tibet and China. In 1882, Major Waddell reported giant footprints in the snow on an expedition to the Himalayas. The local villagers told him that they were made by the hairy man of the snows. So the local villagers very much believe in this creature and think of it as real, and that's really key when you're looking into these ancient mysteries as to what the local people and villagers believe about them. In 1921, Lieutenant Howard Bury traveled to the same area, and his Sherpa guides pointed out three Yeti walking across a snowfield at 23,000 feet. He followed them and found a number of giant footprints. The Sherpas called the creature Metokanmi, which translates to Abominable Snowman. And this really helped kick off the legend. Once again, this was in the 1920s. Strong interest in the mystery intensified in the 1950s when Eric Shipton came back to the U.S. with a famous photograph of a 13-inch long footprint of a Yeti. Sightings have been rare, but recently cryptozoologists have glimpsed a 7-foot-tall monster that weighed approximately 700 pounds, if you can imagine, but they have been unable to produce a clear picture. They report the creature is extremely shy and a master of his environment. So nymphs and fairies, unicorns and mermaids, trolls and ogres, the list goes on and on. The evidence today is minimal, but the writings, artwork, and folklore of the ancients leave us with a powerful tradition. So the mystery and the search continues for adventurous researchers and explorers. And if you buy my DVDs, I really get into the clay tablets, which are the oldest writings known to mankind, and they go back 6,000 years. And they talk about the Anunnaki, this group of giants, and they talk about them being geneticists and engineers and doing a lot, and I mean a lot, of experimentation in regards to mixing animals and humans and even the apes that used to be upon this land, primitive, almost like a primitive ape. And they did a lot of human-animal experimentation according to the Sumerian clay tablets. I don't know if it's true or not. All I can tell you in my research is here's what the ancient writings say. Here's what the ancient peoples believed. And it's up to you to decide if this is mythology or if there is some truth to this. So my understanding, according to the tablets, is a lot of these experiments were failures. They were disasters. And there were all kinds of strange beasts upon the land before the flood. And it was, quite frankly, it was fine with the Anunnaki when the flood wiped out most of the earth, except for Noah and his group of animals. And they were able to start fresh. That was just fine with the Anunnaki because apparently they had made quite a mess with this genetic experimentation. So just read as much as you can about the clay tablets. The works of Zachariah Sitchin are important. But if you want a good summary with visuals, with pictures, that's a bit easier, please buy my DVDs and go to the Odyssey webpage, Mondays at 8 p.m. Look up Odyssey, click on my webpage, and you will see a scan of my first and second DVD. And my third one is coming. I've sent it off to the production staff, and that should be up soon, the front and back cover. And my third one is called Mystery Islands. Okay, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about ancient ruins across the globe. Let's journey to Ireland and examine the mysterious stone round towers that dot the landscape. Generally, these are referred to as medieval artifacts, but their origins stretch back much further. The stone monuments found all throughout Ireland date back to at least the 11th century, and some of the foundational work dates back to the 4th century. 70 towers still remain in the Irish countryside, and 3 are in Scotland. Some of them soar to heights of over 100 feet. They share the same unique architectural features. The entrance was above ground level, and a stepladder was climbed to get inside. The ladders were permanent, so it doesn't appear that these stone towers were a fortress or a means of hiding from enemies. 2 walls of block and mortar construction were built a few feet from each other, and the inner space was filled with sand and rock rubble. A similar technique was used by the Romans, though they never conquered this far to the north. There is speculation that the towers were built by traveling masons or Christian missionaries from England or Rome. Regardless, the architecture is a methodical blueprint that is followed closely in all of the towers and was most likely built by a specific group. There is a strange lack of reference to the towers in the Christian church history of Ireland. According to historian H. O'Brien, they were built long ago by a race of gods or an offshoot of the Anunnaki, or giants. He believes their leader was a female goddess named Danu, and they settled on these lands of the west and conquered the area around Ireland. These towers are fairly advanced construction design, which long outlived the Celtic churches of the era, were the dwellings of the giants, or the Anunnaki, and a place of sun and moon worship. So in my field, what we look for are advanced construction techniques that are used that survive way beyond what the locals built. For instance, like I just mentioned, the Celtic churches of the era have long since vanished because they had poor primitive construction techniques. So this appears to be advanced technology way ahead of its time. And once again, they're called the Irish stone towers or Irish round towers. And let's talk about some of the megaliths in France. Let's journey to the rugged, rocky northern coast of France, to a magical, enchanted area known as Brittany. This land has been fought over and occupied by the English and the Celtics, but is now a part of France. There's a massive ancient ruin known as the Grand Menhir, or Great Stone in Brittany. This giant megalith reaches 50 feet high and weighs an incredible 300 tons, or about 7 times the largest of the Stonehenge rock carvings. The Grand Menhir has cracked into 4 large chunks, and possibly this occurred when an unknown group attempted to raise it upright. The stone is not from a local quarry and was somehow transported several miles. So you've got to see this to believe it. If you go online, look up the Grand Menhir. It's spelled M-E-N-H-I-R, and it's, once again, 300 tons. Just a massive, massive stone monument that was carved out in one piece. And to lift that type of giant megalith today, you would need one of the largest cranes in the world, and still it would be an extremely difficult task. So it's estimated to be several thousand years old, similar to the time of Stonehenge. So clearly this appears to be a remnant of advanced technology, pointing to the Anunnaki once again. Brittany is also the home of over 3,000 smaller stone monuments in the area of Karnak. They are lined up in mysterious formations, like silent tablets, standing guard across the countryside. Others are arranged in circular formations, and still another grouping of 9 stones is covered by a large capstone, forming a small chamber. This mysterious land around Karnak also features a large mound of earth known as a tumulus. This is a burial ground and features stone chests, pottery, and other artifacts to honor royal kings and rulers. And Karnak is spelled C-A-R-N-A-C. So all throughout Europe, some group went to a lot of trouble to carve out these stone megaliths or monoliths and place them in various formations all across the land. And a lot of them are on ley lines, these ancient ley lines, and many of them are oriented to the astronomy, to the universe, whether it's the sun or the moon or the planets. So clearly this is indicative of having advanced knowledge of space and the universe, and who would have that better than space travelers? So I'll leave you with Newport Tower. This is a similar type of tower to the Ireland stone towers right here in America. It's known as Newport Tower, and it's based in Rhode Island. The grandfather of Benedict Arnold refers to the stone tower in his will. So historians believe it dates back to at least the 1600s. Many believe the early colonists built it, but that appears to be unlikely as they were fighting fiercely for their survival with the Indians. If they had the resources and energy to devote to such a project, they surely would have built a fortress, rather than what appears to be a decorative religious structure. Some believe it was once a windmill, but a stone fireplace on the second floor discounts this theory. Researchers have found runic-type letters which date the structure back to 1000 AD and indicate possible early Viking construction. The similarity to the mysterious Irish towers leave others to believe they are remnants from an advanced civilization present in America long before Columbus. So check out pictures of the Newport Tower online again. Once again, that's in Rhode Island. One of the earliest structures here in America, with a very advanced technique form of construction. So we're all out of time. I want to thank you for joining me on Odyssey today. We have Deborah Hill. Please check out her book on limiting your beliefs and overcoming them. And if you type in Deborah Hill into Amazon, you can find her book. And thanks once again for joining me on Odyssey. Please check out my DVDs on my webpage. They're $20. And we'll arrange to ship them out to you, and we use PayPal, the secure server. So thanks a lot, and I will see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.